Phil Rodriguez was the first Lewis book that I stumbled over. I discovered Lewis in college, and I thought I was just going to pick up every single C.S. Lewis book and instantly fall in love with it.
You're listening to All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast. I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com, the creator and host of the show. I have Dr. David Downing, who has been on several episodes of All About Jack, with me today. However, it's not because he has written a new book. Rather, he is the editor of a special version of a title by C.S. Lewis that is somewhat obscure, except to those who are serious readers of his works. The book is The Pilgrim's Regress, and David has produced what's called the Wade Annotated Edition. Welcome back to All About Jack, David.
Thanks, William. I'm glad to be speaking to you again.
Well, let's start off by me acknowledging that The Pilgrim's Regress is a book that I pretty much hate it. However, The Pilgrim's Regress, the Wade Annotated Edition, is a title I've been enjoying very much. So, David, was it for maybe people like me that you created this version? Or actually, let's have you tackle the question this way. Why is Lewis's book so difficult for many readers?
Well, that's a good question, and you are correct. I did write it for people like you. I also wrote it for myself. Pilgrim's Regress was the first Lewis book that I stumbled over. I discovered Lewis in college. I love the Ransom Trilogy. I love the Narnia Chronicles, Mere Christianity, Screwtape Letters. And I thought I was just going to pick up every single C.S. Lewis book and instantly fall in love with it. And Pilgrim's Regress was my first stumbling block. And it sounds like it was also for you. I actually have a friend who said he threw away Pilgrim's Regress. He was so frustrated by all the foreign phrases and all the biblical allusions which he didn't understand that he literally didn't want the book in the house. So I often, when I speak at conferences, I hear the same thing. I hear people say that's the one book they couldn't finish or they got frustrated with. As partly it was Lewis's first book, he wrote it in 2 weeks after he became a Christian, and he said in a letter that he really wasn't trying to reach a broad audience. He wasn't trying to be a popular author. He said he was trying to write for the intellectual elite of his generation. So that's part of the problem, is he had a very small, well-educated audience in mind. And as he became popular, people like you and me wanted to read all of his books. And so we need some help getting through the early ones like Pilgrim's Regress.
In terms of, since this is a annotated edition, some people may not be too familiar. Actually, we were talking just before we started recording that, aside from the Screwtape Letters, this is the only other annotated edition of a book that I have. So what types of helps do you have for the reader to overcome the challenges that is typically faced in the Pilgrim's Regress?
As you read Pilgrim's Regress, the first thing that you note is there are 5 foreign languages which are untranslated. As I say, he was writing for highly educated university students, so you will run into Greek with actual Greek lettering. You'll run into Latin, a lot of it from the Latin Vulgate Bible. There's some French, there's some German, there's some medieval Italian, there's some Middle English. So even if you were well-educated on Bible allusions and the cultural allusions to Kant and Leibniz, the first thing you're going to struggle with is the foreign phrases. So my initial sense was, as a starting point, I need to translate all these foreign language phrases for contemporary readers. After I got done with that, I realized there are a lot of Bible allusions that readers wouldn't recognize, and also a lot of literary quotations they wouldn't recognize. And then there are quite a few characters that Lewis had someone specific in mind who was prominent in the 20s and 30s when he wrote the book. But nowadays, people wouldn't know D.H. Lawrence as well, or they wouldn't even know as much about Ezra Pound or T.S. Eliot. So they need some help identifying the characters that Lewis is satirizing in a number of the chapters in Pilgrim's Regress. The part that I did that was probably the most speculative was to cross-reference this book with his later more famous books. There are a number of passages in Pilgrim's Regress where it almost serves as a sketchbook for his later books. So there's an image of a beautiful, pure queen on an island, which can't help make you think of Perelandra. There's an image of a long-bearded wizard that makes you think of Voyage of the Dawn Treader. So I was fascinated by how many of his ideas were developing in the early 30s that didn't come out until sometimes 20 years later in some of his more famous books.
Well, now there's actually an additional help that you provide that's letting Lewis speak himself. You actually included notes made by Lewis in a copy he first gave to a student. Tell us about these notes and how you obtained them.
That was a real serendipity. I didn't even know about those notes when I started started this project, I decided, for the reasons we've been discussing, that someone should do a guide to Pilgrim's Regress. And I was talking to Marjorie Mead, who is the Associate Director of the Wade Center, which is associated with Wheaton College in a suburb of Chicago. And they have a wonderful study center there with a lot of unpublished documents and scholarly works on Lewis, Tolkien, and five other famous Christian writers. And I told her that I wanted to write an interpretive guide to Pilgrim's Regress to help readers with all these foreign phrases and these cultural allusions. And she said, you know what? And she got a twinkle in her eye, and she says, there's something I want to show you. And she took me, I thought she was going to take me to the wardrobe and show me a trapdoor that led to Narnia. They have a famous wardrobe from Lewis's home in Northern Ireland. But she showed me this edition from 1935, which had no interpretive helps at all. The later editions have running headlines from C.S. Lewis and have a very helpful preface from C.S. Lewis. The early edition was just the main text with no interpretive aids. And she said a student of his named R.T. Hewitt apparently was struggling with the meaning of the book and asked Lewis to annotate it himself. So she showed me an edition from 1937, which has Lewis's handwritten notes in the margins, which explain Bible allusions and explain that this is based on a book he read by an American humanist named Irving Babbitt. And she said they'd been wanting to do an annotated edition, but there wasn't enough material just supplied by Lewis, and they were waiting for someone like me to come along and take Lewis's annotations and add to them some further annotations with translations and identifying characters and allusions. So it was kind of a wonderful serendipity that they were hoping someone would come along to supplement the work that Lewis had already done himself in helping people understand the book.
Well, now, David, one of the things I enjoyed is the fact that you don't, for lack of a better expression, over-annotate. You didn't explain every little detail, but at times, to be honest, I did find myself maybe wanting more in some cases, and I'm sure there may be others on the other extreme that wondered why you bothered to include some facts because it was so clear to them. How did you strike a balance?
Well, I was working from the model of the annotated Alice in Wonderland, which is a famous annotated edition by Martin Gardner, and it's in some places helpful to have all these inside jokes from Alice in Wonderland. In other places, it's overwhelming. The annotations fill the entire margin and run on to the next page. So if you're not careful, you'll get so lost in the annotations, you don't remember where you were in the main story. And my editors at Erdmann's and I agreed that we didn't want the annotations to overwhelm the main text. So we decided to put the most obvious annotations, such as the foreign phrase that needed translating, or a character that was based on a real historical person or a real author, in the side notes, which are on the same page as the main text. Occasionally, Lewis would say, in identifying a character such as Mr. Sensible, he gives 10 different names of people that reminded him of Mr. Sensible, who's an embodiment of cultured worldliness. No actual spirituality there, no actual depth, but extremely well-read. And to try to identify 10 different characters in the margin would just overwhelm the reader. So we decided to take what we consider to be the primary identifications and put them in side notes on the same page, and then take more secondary material to amplify in greater depth in the end notes in the back of the book. I think in a perfect world, you'd have very wide margins and you'd be able to put everything you wanted to know about a particular page on that text. But in that case, I'm afraid the annotations would tend to overshadow the main text. And we always wanted Lewis's work to be primary here rather than the annotations.
Well, as we've already noted, but people may not necessarily have it caught on, the fact that the cover states that this is a Wade annotated edition. What was their involvement, and briefly share what the Wade Center is for those who may not be as familiar?
The Marion E. Wade Center, it's called, is centered in Wheaton College in Illinois. This was founded in 1965 by Dr. Clyde Kilby. He was an early scholar of Lewis and Tolkien, and I think he farsightedly realized that their reputations were only going to grow through the years. So he began collecting some of their unpublished letters, their manuscripts and documents, as well as a lot of scholarly material. And this is now the scholarly center for studying Lewis and Tolkien, probably the American equivalent to the Bodleian Library at Oxford. So when I went there, not only did I find this edition by R.T. Hewitt with Lewis's handwritten annotations, they also have a 62-page unpublished autobiography that Lewis started in 1930 or 1931. And this was sort of a rough draft of Surprise by Joy. Oddly, when he wrote it, he only considered himself a theist, not a Christian, so his spiritual journey wasn't really completed. But it was very illuminating for me to read that unpublished autobiography. It gives a lot of clues as to what he was referring to in Pilgrim's Regress, which he wrote the following year in the summer of 1932. Just to give you a particular example, the character John has this experience of sweet desire, and he sees this island, and it's almost this somewhere over the rainbow experience of longing for this other, better world. And initially, he's wondering, he wants to go on a quest to find where is that beautiful island that he's seeking. And he meets a young woman who he calls a brown girl, and they have sexual relations. And then he realizes that somehow he's confused about what is merely lust and what is actual sweet desire. And some critics have been confused by the brown girls, and they didn't know if that had racial overtones. And when I read this unpublished autobiography, I realized that Lewis was thinking of a book called The Well at the World's End by William Morris, in which the main character keeps running into farm girls and barmaids and women who are bathing out of doors. And there's a lot of amorous episodes. And he mentions several times their tan skin and their outdoorsy look. So I think that unpublished manuscript helped me identify what he meant by the brown girls and why he called them brown girls.
What you're just saying leads naturally to my next question, or to give some further information here, and that is, turning to the annotations themselves, briefly review maybe the different types of annotations. I think you noted that to some extent, but go over that again, and then give some additional or give some examples of annotations in addition to what you've already said.
Well, as I'm looking at the end of book one, John has had this experience of looking at this vision of paradise and wondering if there's somewhere he could make a pilgrimage to that location. And we're reading about John trying to find paradise, but the chapter title is Leah for Rachel. And a lot of readers are going to say, what in the world do these two female names have to do with the storyline? There's no character named Leah, there's no character named Rachel. And so they need to know the story in Genesis where Jacob falls in love with a beautiful daughter, Rachel. But in order to take Rachel as a wife, his father-in-law insists that first he marry Leah, who's the plain daughter. And so Leah for Rachel is a kind of shorthand saying that he was seeking after Rachel, this beautiful vision of the island, and instead he got Leah, which was merely physical lust. So that title seems to have nothing to do with the story, but if you know the Bible story, you'll understand what he's trying to say symbolically with that title. The same thing happens in the next chapter. You're reading along about his disillusionment, thinking that physical lust is certainly not as powerful as the vision that he's had of this paradisal island. But the chapter is called Ichabod, and most readers will go, maybe they'll think of Ichabod Crane, the character in the story about the headless horseman. They need to go back to the Bible to discover that Ichabod means the glory has departed, which is another Old Testament allusion. And they realize for John, the glory has departed because he realizes that what he thought was the fulfillment of his vision is certainly not at all relevant to his vision of paradise. The very next chapter is called Quim Quaterus in Sepulchro, Non Est Hic. And unless you're up on your Vulgate Bible, you will have no idea what that Latin phrase means.
Well, now, I use that phrase means every day, David. No.
Oh, is that right? Well, yeah, I guess some of us who do our daily devotions with the Latin Bible would be more up on that. But once again, if you get a translation, you realize that's a reference to the risen Christ in the grave and the angel saying he's not here. And Lewis is constantly thinking symbolically in terms of symbolic parallels, and he's saying you're looking for the risen Christ in the wrong place. But the titles seem to be a total mismatch with the storyline. None of those phrases or none of those names come up in the story. And you have to realize that they're all symbolic allusions to something in the Bible, either in English or in Latin. So there's three chapters in a row where most readers need quite a bit of help to understand these strange titles.
Now that brings to mind something else that you note that was helpful for me. Or actually, I didn't necessarily notice it, but then I'm sure I would have at some point, and that is he repeats chapter titles for two or three chapters from the previous one. And you, I believe, note that, you know, some people think because he did finish this in such a short time. I remember hearing your lecture, which we'll talk about in a minute, when you did, that you did at the Wade Center, but that Lewis just missed this editing to correct that. He was being careless, but that's not, in fact, the case.
That's correct. Some critics have said that he uses the same three unusual chapter titles twice, and they say, well, he wrote the whole thing in 2 weeks while he was on vacation in Ireland. That in itself is amazing, because the book has over 500 allusions and references, and sometimes direct quotes from the Bible, from Kant, from Milton. But we realize he was on holiday. He probably didn't have his library with him, so most of these he carried around in his head. He had a photographic memory, and literally in collecting the sources for this project, all the allusions that he uses in this book, there's over 500 allusions. I had an entire bookcase full of books that he was quoting. And to think that he carried that bookcase around in his head all the time is rather amazing to me. But back to the question of the repeated titles, some critics have felt he was composing rapidly and he carelessly started reusing titles. But I think if you look at the story more closely, you realize that it's a purposeful echoing. The first time he seeks for this vision of paradise in what is clearly just meant to be a lustful episode of meeting this woodland girl, this brown girl. The second time he meets a much more sophisticated woman who represents romanticism, and she's very seductive and beautiful, and this seems like a whole new episode, but he realizes at the end that this is just disguised love. So I think the echoing is deliberate on his part. It's another cul-de-sac in terms of John's spiritual pilgrimage. It's not an accidental repetition.
Turning to a more personal question, what has the Pilgrim's Regress book itself, what has it meant to you, or how has it been meaningful?
Actually, even the first time I read it, there was a lot of it I didn't get, and these Latin phrases and some of the allusions I didn't understand. But when I went to graduate school, a lot of these cultural figures were still very prominent, and they were more or less unquestioned. I had a professor who did straight Freudian readings of literature, and he would talk about Oedipus complexes and death wishes and all that. And I always suspected that a lot of Freud was too speculative. I didn't see the scientific basis for repression. I had another professor who was a Marxist, and he would teach everything in terms of the class struggle and the bourgeoisie who were oppressing the proletariat. And I had other professors who were very into literary modernism, and you simply couldn't criticize T.S. Eliot as being too obscure or James Joyce's Ulysses as being too obscure. There's a kind of intellectual fundamentalism where these authors, once they achieve a certain status, they're canonical and they're inerrant, and you can't say, well, I didn't enjoy T.S. Eliot because it was too obscure, or I didn't enjoy Ulysses. And Lewis gave me permission to say, to question Freud, to question Marx, to question literary modernism. Here he was back in 1933. He was actually very prescient as a cultural prophet, because he was able to identify a lot of cultural fads that didn't have staying power. It's well known now that Freud is not a major psychological thinker. He's culturally influential, but he's not used in psychology. And most people would say that Marx didn't understand economic systems. So I think even though I didn't understand a lot of the book, it gave me permission to question a lot of things which my professors were telling me that I should be taking seriously and not questioning. So that was probably the main benefit for me on my first reading. In going back to Pilgrim's Regress more recently, what struck me was, even though there is a lot of obscurity, Lewis's beautiful prose style still comes through. In rereading this edition, I was struck that even in his 30s, Lewis was already developing that sparkling prose, which he later became famous for in Mere Christianity and Screwtape Letters. So the humor comes through a lot better when you have the annotations. And also, when you understand what's going on, you notice how well-written the book is, just his prose style.
Definitely. In fact, having now read in the last 5 years more of Lewis's works completely, compared to when I first got the Pilgrim's Regress. I have my copy actually here in front of me while we're interviewing. And back then, I noted the date I bought it, and I noted that when I bought it in 82, actually, I find like a bookmark towards the end suggesting I may not have even finished reading it because I had such troubles.
Right.
But then now, having read nearly all of Lewis's works, being fairly familiar with his autobiography and other works, I see that foreshadowing that you were talking about earlier.
I think you're correct. The first time I read Pilgrim's Regress, I'm almost sure that I stopped when I got to Mr. Sensible, because he's the one who quotes in Greek and Latin and French and German, and I didn't know any of those languages well, and I believe I probably have a dog-eared page where I stopped reading the first time. I mentioned earlier I had a friend who actually threw the book away. He didn't even want it in the house. He found it so frustrating. So if nothing else, I believe this edition will help readers get all the way through the storyline and understand what's going on.
Exactly. Well, now, we already made a comment just a few minutes ago about Lewis finishing the book in 2 weeks. Pretty, very, very rapid and rare to accomplish something like that. Now, so how long of a process was it for your annotated edition, per se? But more seriously, were there some unexpected twists and turns, which I guess you've mentioned to some extent, but if could you speak to maybe the length of time and maybe other people's works that are unpublished that helped you in the process?
Well, I think it's probably a fair comparison of Lewis's mind and my mind that for every week it took him to compose the book, it took me about a year to interpret the book. It took him 2 weeks to write the book, and it took me 2 years to unravel all the allusions and all the secondary symbolism. I think one of the most important things that happened to me in doing the interpretations, I found some great online sources. There's one by a fellow named Aaron Smilda, in which he is able to provide a lot of the allusions which are very obscure to Aristotle and Kant and Leibniz and all these other philosophers that get mentioned in the story. I think my biggest breakthrough was a note by Lewis in his own handwriting where he said that part of the reason he was so irritated with these characters he calls the three pale men who are counter-romantics. They make fun of romanticism and sweet desire and the vision of the island. That whole idea of seeking somewhere over the rainbow, they consider that to be rather silly and sentimental. And he mentioned a book by Irvin Babbitt called Rousseau and Romanticism. And when I went back and read that particular book, and I discovered a very caustic attitude toward sweet desire, toward romanticism, before this human longing for some paradise which seems to be out of reach. And I believe it's the caustic tone of that particular book which brought out a rather caustic tone in Pilgrim's Regress. He later apologized for its uncharitable temper. And I think, for me, it was a breakthrough to realize that he was responding to a particular book that he found rather arrogant. That same book also defines romanticism very narrowly in terms of the vision of paradise, which various writers have talked about. And I think that explains why Lewis is also interpreting romanticism in rather narrow terms. He went back and wrote a very helpful preface in which he explains there are 8 or 9 major definitions of romanticism, and he was only dealing with one of them, which is the longing for paradise. So I believe that was my major breakthrough in doing the work, was discovering that reading the book, which kind of set Lewis off. I think part of the reason he wrote it in 2 weeks, it may have been kind of a fury of indignation trying to answer some of the accusations that have been made in this book by Irving Babbitt.
Well, shifting gears here, I'm going to have links in the show notes for people to find the previous shows that you've been on. Instead of having you review them, let's have you look ahead maybe and share what Lewis-related projects you have coming in the near future or hope to.
Well, I wrote a novel called Looking for the King, which came out in 2010 from Ignatius Press. Often when I speak on Lewis or Tolkien at conferences, people say, is it true they were best friends? Is it true they sat around in pubs and talked about literature and fantasy and they read each other's works aloud? And I say, yes, that's all true. These two great minds were actually also great friends. And they often say, oh, I'd love to be a fly on the wall, see what it would be like to be in the room with Lewis and Tolkien. So I wrote a novel called Looking for the King, in which I tried to recreate the experience of two young Americans meeting Lewis and Tolkien before they were very famous. That's been doing well enough that my publisher would like me to do a sequel. Right now I'm doing research for a sequel which takes place 2 years later in 1942. It's still set in England during World War II, but Lewis and Tolkien and Charles Williams will appear again. So that's my current project, is another fiction, writing my own fiction.
All right. In fact, that was one of the interviews that we did. We did have one, and I'll have a link in the show notes to that interview where we chatted about that, and look forward to that book coming out down the road. Of course, if people are listening to this later than when we actually recorded it in the fall of 2014, maybe it's already available. They can search for that just based on your name as an author or the other book and noting that there's a sequel. Well, now let's go ahead and wrap up here and have you just summarize again some key reasons why listeners would want to get an annotated version of The Pilgrim's Regress.
Well, I think the key reason is that the original book is simply too obscure, with too many foreign phrases, too many allusions which they will no longer recognize. But the story is well worth reading. It's a very insightful critique of 20th century culture. And with a little help from the side notes and from the end notes, I think they will realize that even though Lewis originally wrote this for a rather narrow, well-educated audience, that it's still widely applicable if you get some interpretive aids from Lewis himself and from me as a scholar trying to explain some of his allusions. I think a lot of people who gave up on this book and they have it on their unread shelf or their unfinished shelf, if they get some side notes and some help, they can probably move it to their favorite shelf. They'll discover it's actually a delightful story once you get past the obscure part.
That is indeed actually a case for me. Of course, people often say, or I've heard some people that I've interviewed, you know, what's your favorite Lewis book? And they probably end up sharing that the one they've been reading most recently, which this is what I've been reading most recently. But even apart from that, it definitely went from being one that would be my least favorite to one that I'm very much enjoying and would probably enter up into the top 10, considering Lewis had, you know, 40 books and stuff. So it's very much a very good aid. So we encourage people to get a copy of this. And then one of the things I don't know that we noted here is that you made passing reference to it. I'll have a link in the show notes. That is to the fact that when you spoke at the Wade Center, that they did record that. I'll have a link so people can also have some additional enjoyments to some insights that you shared then. Well, David, thanks again for being with me here on All About Jack.
Yeah, it was great talking to you, William. I always enjoy our stimulating conversations, and I hope other people will too.
Again, yeah, I'm William O'Flaherty, and let me thank you, the listener, for joining me today. And be sure to check, again, those show notes at EssentialCSLewis.com for links mentioned during the program. And now also directly, you can go directly to where the podcast is hosted, which is at a relatively new location, allaboutjack.podbean.com. Again, allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. Some of the, besides the past shows with Dr. Downing, I have had interviews with Dr. Alistair McGrath, Dr. Devin Brown, and Colin Duryea. I've shared a few of my own talks. I shared about some quotations falsely attributed to Lewis. And then in 2014, it was the 75th anniversary of Lewis's first sermon. I share a adaptation podcast of a talk that I gave. So again, that's EssentialCSLewis.com. And I hope you can stop by there and check out some of the other resources.